This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. What follows is the first of a two-part show featuring the panel discussion from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. I also plan to share highlights from the various keynote presentations. For this podcast, you'll hear a majority of the answers the panel gave to questions from Joe Rickey, the conference coordinator and host for the panel discussion. The theme for the 2018 colloquium was The Faithful Imagination, and the guests were Stephen Prickett, Crystal Downing, Joe Christopher, Crystal Hurd, and Charlie Starr. I'll provide brief bios of those individuals at the end of this episode.
This is my panel, and it's Joe Christopher, Crystal Downing, Stephen Prickett, Crystal Hurd, and Charlie Starr. I'll ask some questions, and they will respond, and truthfully, because we have somewhat limited time, and I know most of these speakers, I may even cut them off occasionally and say, next person. But because we want everyone pretty much to answer every question. But also, I'm sure they're going to start asking each other things and that sort of thing, and it'll be great. I wanted to ask everyone on the panel a very simple question. How did you first discover or come in contact with, and then I will let you fill in the blank. I would normally say C.S. Lewis and his works, but it doesn't have to be that, because maybe your real passion is Dorothy Sayers or George MacDonald, in which case I'm happy for that to be your response. But, you know, what was to our circle of writers that we call Lewis and Friends. But, of course, we're always trying to extend that circle, too, because I want Austin Farrar to be in it, and I want his wife, Kathleen Farrar, to be in it. I mean, these are important people, and eventually we're going to collect their books, too. But so we'll just start with Joe.
I was in junior high school. I was in the garage of my home reading science fiction. I read an Asimov novel, a Lewis Out of the Silent Planet, and a Heinlein novel. And I thought when I read Out of the Silent Planet, that's a curious, old-fashioned piece of science fiction. I came back to it later.
Crystal? I was assigned Mere Christianity when I was a sophomore in college, but I discovered Dorothy Sayers because after my husband got his PhD at UCLA, we came back to the college where we met, and I was quite disturbed that there was no course in women's literature at this college. So I had gotten a job as a secretary in the alumni office, and after a year, they fired my boss and made me the alumni director. I was 23 years old. And the director of public relations was 24, and I think they knew we would work hard and for little pay. And so she and I decided we need to offer a course in women's literature, and we were willing to offer it for the Jan term, so it was only 3 weeks, and they knew we couldn't hurt literature too much in 3 weeks. And we offered to do it for free, and she said, well, we need to include Dorothy Sayers. And I said, who's that? So she gave me a copy, because I was teaching the Brontes and George Eliot. She gave me a copy of Whose Body, and that's how my involvement with Sayers started.
Stephen?
I think you all know the answer to this already. Lewis was giving the first year lectures in Cambridge, and, you know, I was told that I had to go to his lectures, so I went to his lectures. Full stop. End of story.
No, I'm gonna press him on that one a little bit. Stephen, if I may, you are the president of the George MacDonald Society, are you not? Are you the president of the George MacDonald Society?
Yes, I am, yes.
And I'd like to ask you, because I think we would be interested in that.
Okay.
Trying to how did that come about? How did you get interested in George MacDonald and start doing his work?
My mother read me The Princess and the Goblin when I was, I think, 4 years old. And I didn't do the Princess and Curdie at that stage, but I remember The Princess and the Goblin very distinctly. Of course, I didn't remember the name of George MacDonald. And years later, I read it again and thought, hello, I know this story. But I happened to know that we moved house at just that point. So I think I was 4 or 5 years old at that point.
Thank you. Crystal?
I had graduated in 2001 from the University of Tennessee, and I was, like many English majors, taught all the fun critical exercises that are mental gymnastics when you're an English major, and I was looking for something that had the same depth, but the spiritual aspects as well, and I was working at a soul-crushing job at a call center for a major cell phone company. And someone, I don't even remember who it was. I wish I could. I'd send him a fruit basket. But someone said, have you ever read Mere Christianity? And I'm like, no. Is it a Christian writer? But, you know, I was wanting that same depth and analysis. And I read two chapters of Mere Christianity. And I'm like, I want to buy everything this guy's written. And then I looked at Wikipedia and saw how much stuff he'd published. And I'm like, crap. I'm going to need a third kidney to sell.
Freshman year of college, first semester, required course in apologetics, several books required reading for book reports. I think there were five books, which to a college freshman was horrid, and one of the books was Mere Christianity, and it went from there.
Charlie, do you remember any of the other books on that list?
I know that one of them was also Francis Schaeffer's Escape from Reason.
Very good. I want to ask something that's a little more not scholarly, and we'll move into some more scholarly questions. I hope that this, given the makeup of us together here as a community, we have a lot of interest. What is it that in your personal life, you know, what do you feel that you really owe to this writer? And again, it doesn't have to be C.S. Lewis. You could take one of our writers. It could be MacDonald Sayers. Someone wants to say Barfield, I'm fine with that. And, you know, that sort of question, something maybe a little more personal. Now, Stephen started at 4, Crystal started when she was 21 reading Dorothy Sayers, Joe was 14 reading sci-fi. Was that what it was, Joe? Something like that? So, but what now over the course of a life, you know, has been really meaningful, and it's hard, of course, to pick out one thing, but that is what I'm asking. You know, what's the one sort of impact on your life or the influence on your life? This author. We're going to start down at the other end with Charlie, please.
So I attended college at a conservative Bible college in the Dallas area, and I can remember being taught the very important things that Bible-believing Christians were supposed to believe, that when asked the question, is the Bible literal or figurative, you must answer that it is literal. So when Jesus says, I am the door, I'm supposed to look for a knob. But I didn't even think in those terms, all right? It just made sense. I had been taught an approach to truth that was not a biblical approach to truth. It was an Enlightenment model of truth defended by conservative Bible-believing Christians in order to defend the Bible. That is, they had adopted the enemy's model and stepped into the enemy's camp to defend the truth, and then failed to understand that they were no longer the home team and lacked the advantage of the home crowd. Then in my master's degree, I turned to the literature and the arts with a wonderful teacher, Louise Cowan, who is known across the nation as somebody significant in trying to return the classics to literature, and even received the Viktor Frankl Award for Humanities from President George H.W. Bush when he was in office. And I can remember the opening lecture that Louise taught me, which was, we have to talk about the imagination as a mode of knowing. And this idea that imagination had epistemological significance was brand new to me. No one had ever taught me that. No one had discussed it. I could not comprehend it at first, and when I came to comprehend it, I then found that there was a Christian writer who understood this, and his name was C.S. Lewis. And at one point, I became utterly and completely hooked, and I know when. It's when I went Till We Have Faces in 1994 or so. And at that point, I became hooked and realized here was somebody who was teaching modes of thought, ways of thinking, and writing a kind of literature that Christians desperately needed to be pursuing. In their own arts, but then in their own processes of thinking. And he has meant so much to me in the sense that he didn't baptize my imagination, he gave me one.
Like a lot of you, perhaps. Maybe I'm being presumptuous, but I grew up in a pretty conservative situation in a church that always made me want to wear a dress. And then when I'd ask why, they'd say it's in the Bible. And I'd say, where? They'd just shut up and just do what I ask. Put on a skirt. I hate skirts to this day. I don't know why that is. But I think when I read Lewis, he gave me permission to doubt. You know, I had all these, I think, you know, a lot of us have a dark night of the soul experience in our faith at points. And Lewis consoled me that it's okay. It's permitted. And then sometimes it's required to deepen our faith. So Lewis told me that you can marry intellect and faith, and you can marry intellect, faith, and imagination. And my church was very fine with fiction. I wasn't told it was lies and all that stuff. I don't know, some people have, but he gave me permission to ask questions, and that was invaluable to me. I couldn't quiet those inquiries. And Lewis said, "That's totally fine. Let's talk apologetics, and why you feel this way and why humans feel this way." And so, for me, that has been significant to me as a human being. And now as an educator, to say it's okay to ask questions. Don't just trust me. Go look it up. Don't just trust me. Go consult other sources.
Well, my experience, I think, is fundamentally different to a great many people's experience here. I had never met a biblical literalist before I went to college. I was brought up in a Christian household. My father was a Methodist minister. My mother's father was a Methodist minister. My great-grandfather was a Methodist minister who had been defrocked twice in various countries for sexual offenses against his congregation. But this did not involve biblical interpretation, as far as I know. At least he had a line that I haven't yet discovered, to put it that way. But when I went to I went to a Christian school as well. And it was assumed that modern science and Christianity fitted together. Many people going to university had sharp challenges to their religious faith. I did not. After all, my professors were Lewis and Basil Willey, for whom I also have a huge respect. And so Christianity was intellectually respectable right from the start. We had role models, if you like, and these were all people who were au fait with modern science and were perfectly prepared to incorporate that into their belief systems and to accept, we all accepted that science was today's truth, and tomorrow they will turn around and say, well, actually, that's not true. I mean, I remember the coming of the Big Bang. We didn't have a creation myth for years and years. It was continuous creation from Fred Hoyle. But now we have a Big Bang, I don't know whether but very few people have taken this up as a creation myth. But this is a scientific creation myth, after all. So there was no such conflict in my existence at all. And I think I was very lucky. The first time I met creationists or people who wanted to put the literal interpretation of the Bible in front of modern knowledge was when I came to America.
I, as well, grew up as a fundagelical and went to a fundagelical college. So when I went on to grad school, I then encountered people who told me, because I didn't hide my light under a bushel, they said, one person told me, well, Crystal, you're the first Christian I've ever met who's the least bit intelligent. Wow, what a compliment. And at a wine and cheese party after a lecture, a religion professor at the University of California where I went, I said, well, I believe in God. I wasn't even proclaiming Christ is the Son of God. I believe in God. And I remember he swirled his Chardonnay and said, why aren't you an anachronism? And this was the 1980s. And I went to hear the famous Marxist critic, Frederick Jameson, and he was denouncing postmodernism because postmodernism called into question the truth claims of the linear progress of communism, and he put down postmodernism by saying the trouble with postmodernism is it's just like fundamentalist Christianity. And I thought, what? Yes. And I said, I have to do research on this. And so I got into theory, postmodern theory, which is called the religious turn in philosophy, where essentially there is the sense that all truth claims are predicated on faith. And it was this challenge to this modernist idea that the scientist is getting us at objective truth, and the rest are pseudo-statements, as I.A. Richards put it, and why C.S. Lewis didn't like I.A. Richards. So I got, that got me into then my first book on Dorothy Sayers, because I was claiming that because she was a Christian at the height of modernism, which was dismissing Christianity, she anticipated postmodern discourse, not despite the fact she was a Christian, but because she was a Christian.
Whichever author we were talking about, what was their influence on your personal life, and how did that make a difference in your life?
I guess Lewis, mere Christianity. I grew up going to a... it was a moderate church. The minister one time did a series of sermons on modern theologians, Kierkegaard among them. And the greatest complaint about his doing that was that that should have been in a study that was being done at a different time, that the sermon shouldn't be confused with the study. And so, really, there was assumption that there was no problem with science. There was no problem with lots of things. We didn't worry about them. And I certainly saw difficulties, and I saw difficulties partially in the Paul's theology of the first and second Adam, if there is no first Adam, in evolution. And but I went on to college, state school. I taught in state schools. I suppose, somewhat more secular, but I got through my years at University of Oklahoma partially because I read Mere Christianity. And it gave me a structure of belief. I didn't have to agree with it, but at least I had to argue with it if I didn't. And it was good. It was valuable.
Let's switch gears to talk about books. Let's start with Stephen. Of our authors, and you can choose whichever one you want, and I know this is a difficult question, what's the one book that is your book that I'm trying to avoid the word favorite, but I think maybe I can't come up with a better word. So let's just go with your favorite book or the one that you would most highly recommend to someone else or however you want to approach that. But we want to talk about one book. And let me just say, if everyone says Till We Have Faces, I'm just going to go to the next person. Go ahead, Stephen.
Are we talking about fiction or nonfiction?
No, either. Which book by these authors, yeah?
Because I cannot, I have been enormously influenced by a vast number of books. I can't possibly, I can say the book that I found most interesting recently.
That's fine.
If I can answer that. And that is a book that doesn't seem to be widely known here. It's called The Master and His Emissary. And it's by Ian McGilchrist. Now, Ian McGilchrist has an interesting track record. He is a brain surgeon at the Maudsley Hospital in London, which is one of the leading brain centers of brain surgery in the world. He is a qualified psychiatrist and practiced as a psychiatrist, and he taught English at Oxford. I like a man with width on this kind of thing. It's an extraordinary book. It's about the master and his emissary are the two lobes of the brain. And hit the basic argument, there's an enormous amount about literature, there's an enormous amount about how the brain works. He doesn't ever introduce the idea of original sin, but it's glaringly there in that he thinks that one of the things that has gone wrong in modern society is that the wrong lobe of the brain has taken over from the good. One lobe makes moral judgments, the other one is the executor. And he thinks the executor has tended in our society to take over from the other. It's not always an easy book. It's a very interesting book, and it reshaped my view of the world.
Thank you, Stephen. Crystal Downing?
Mere Christianity was important when I was a sophomore in college for the same reasons that Crystal gave. In terms of my favorite book among the seven authors, it has to be Gaudy Knight, How a Woman Negotiates the Relationship Between Career and Marriage. And I just think it is a very well-written book.
Thanks. Joe?
Till We Have Faces.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, since I can't say Till We Have Faces,
you cannot.
I will say I was privileged several years ago to be able to sit down with a manuscript in C.S. Lewis's own hand, and it took place here at Taylor University, and it was the first time I had ever held a Lewis manuscript in my hand, and that was a bucket list moment. And the manuscript was called Light. Four little pages in one of the most powerful stories, one of the most strange, unusual stories that I've ever seen. And to hold something that Lewis had held in my hand got me hooked on Lewis manuscript work. I love the Light story itself, but I love the fact that I got to transcribe the story, that I got to compare it to the Man Born Blind version of the story, that I got to travel to Oxford, that I got to have tea with Walter Hooper, and then tell him that I thought he was wrong about something, which was incredibly intimidating. I found a good way to do it, and he did agree with me, so that was great. And then I have continued since to find joy in being able to work with Lewis manuscripts, and it's this school and this collection that made that possible. Yeah. But otherwise, Till We Have Faces.
Yeah, three of the five have already told me Till We Have Faces. That's why I said they get to say it. Crystal?
Well, I said Till We Have Faces.
I know.
But since I caved to peer pressure so easily, Mere Christianity is my favorite nonfiction, but being in an MFA has taught me about the perks of fiction writing, which has been interesting, and sort of seeing and analyzing Lewis in a new light as a fiction writer. I want to cheat, okay, and say the Ransom Trilogy, because all of them are brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the Empyrean Ocean of Radiance, that's in Out of Solid Planet, that is the most gorgeous passage in English language, period. I love that.
Heavens versus Space?
Yeah, the first time he's looking out the window.
Heavens to Declare the Glory.
Yes.
Dash. It must be read as Heavens to Declare the Glory, dash. Stephen, which is your George MacDonald work that you would most highly... We have more MacDonald scholars and fans than ever before at the conference this year. But still, a lot of the C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien fans, you know, don't really know a lot about George MacDonald. And so give us the pitch or the, you know, what do you want them to read as the president of the George MacDonald Society that you say, okay, here's the introduction. Here's the one. Because I always tell people The Light Princess because I think it's the greatest fairy tale ever written or close to it. I love it. The Light Princess. But that, of course, that's just one fairy tale. But what for you?
We're talking about personal preferences. Lilith, undoubtedly. Yeah. I think Lilith is the most mind-blowing book. And I throw it at students at the beginning of a course, and they come in sort of looking like that afterwards. But obviously, fantastic. The way in which Phantastes and Lilith bracket MacDonald's life, really. The one from the beginning and one from the end. And I'm glad to say that Lewis seems to have agreed with me on this particular judgment. Yes. I am not a great fan of most of the realistic fiction. I agree with Lewis, I think, that MacDonald was squeezed into an unfamiliar into a form that did not really suit his genius. And so, therefore, I would also then say The Princess and the Goblin, The Princess and Curdie. At the Back of the North Wind is not everybody's taste, but I think it's a very, very interesting book. And I can bore people for hours about At the Back of the North Wind if they're sympathetic. But I will not do so now.
Let's start over with the question that Stephen has already answered, and that is, tell me what you've read recently. That, and now it's not one of these authors. Just, you're sharing with us because we like you and we want to learn, and if we had time, we'd all be sharing this way, and I hope we will maybe later today. People just talk with each other. But what are you reading? What have you read that's impressed you the way the book Stephen just talked about a moment ago?
The Master and His Emissary.
What was it again?
The Master and His Emissary.
The Master and His Emissary. So we'll start with Crystal. Why don't we start with you? Crystal Downing, please. Yeah.
I'll say The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. The subtitle is What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. I've had several conversations over meals about the irony of we are all fascinated with the actual object of a book, how it appeals to the senses on multiple levels, and how future generations are not going to be able to read letters. I realize now that if I were going to respond to what is my favorite Dorothy Sayers text, it would be her collected letters. I think she is more theologically profound and witty in her letters than any one of her single other texts. But we're not going to have letters anymore. People send emails, tweets. There is a loss. And Nicholas Carr was an English major. He loves the internet, but he actually says he felt his brain was changing. So he did research he accessed multiple studies at major research institutions that are actually proclaiming there are neurological damage is happening due to the internet. So it's because it's written by an English major, it's very accessible, and I tell all my students to read it.
Did he find any of his information on the internet? Joe, what about you? What's something you've been reading lately that you want to recommend to the rest of us?
Well, I have been reading Capon's book on parables, and I don't know whether I should recommend it or not. He is fairly liberal. He says interesting things about them. He is sure that Jesus is teaching a thing where the poor, the hopeless, so forth, will be the ones that will be saved, and we can see what he's saying there. He published three books on parables, and they are combined in one book. If you're looking for somebody who is flawless, now I'm talking about writing. He's a lively writer, but his personal life was messy. He's dead. He was married, had six children, and left his family when he fell in love with a married woman. And he talks occasionally about how his church refused to accept a repentant sinner who wasn't planning to give up his sin. But anyway, it's...
It's a book. What's the entire official title?
Really
I know I've read the
parables.
It's The Parables, and it's Capon. Capon. Yeah. Go down, Charlie.
I've been reading Jane Austen, and that's been very nice. But
that's perfectly very fine. Crystal? Crystal Hurd?
Name a book that I've read now probably a decade ago, which is 100 pages, and it seems incredibly simple, and you might even accuse it of being simplistic. But while I was reading it, I was shaking with excitement and a little bit of anger because he had written the book that I intended to write.
Again, you've been listening to the first of a two-part episode featuring the panel discussion from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium, an event that is held every 2 years at Taylor University. Be sure to catch the second part to learn the rest of Charlie Starr's answer and to hear one final question posed to the panel about what's happening in Inkling studies or what they are excited about related to it, as well as some Q&A from the audience. Check the show notes of this episode to get links to Taylor University and past events on Lewis and Friends, as well as a link to the book that came out of the 2016 event featuring a variety of papers presented at that colloquium. You can get those notes at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show, but it might be easier to locate the notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. I mentioned I'd wait until this ending to give a short biographical sketch of the participants. So here it goes, the panel featured Stephen Prickett, Regius Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Glasgow and President of the George MacDonald Society. Crystal Downing, author of the award-winning book, Writing Performances, The Stages of Dorothy Sayers. And she's also the co-director of the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College. Joe Christopher publishes regularly about Lewis, including over 20 essays on Lewis's often neglected poetry, and is on the executive board of the C.S. Lewis and Inkling Society. Crystal Hurd, book review editor of Zanzook, the C.S. Lewis Journal, and she also contributed to the book Women and C.S. Lewis. And finally, Charlie Starr, author of The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. And he's also the expert on Lewis's handwriting. In case you didn't know, you can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link and consider rating my podcast there. Finally, let me remind you, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack. In addition to my new book, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, that explores 75 questionable quotations and also reveals the closest expression Lewis wrote related to the questionable saying, I've also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Thanks again for listening to All About Jack.